Venus, the cradle of humankind, remained shrouded and bereft of life after the Pleistocene cycle of solar expansion, its fruitful eons of fertility at an end and its vast warm seas that nurtured are beginning dried out and barren. But her glory still remains as a reality in the electric mirage, perfected by her progeny, who were compelled to move from her protective surface out into the far reaches of space to propagate their species on the surface of an alien planet called Earth. There we adapted to the different time speed on a younger planet. Laying claim to Earth as a host to life, we continued to perfect our spaceships in readiness for the time when we would have to leave this solar system, prior to another wave of mass extinctions from the system's star. We knew we would have to adapt to an entirely new dimension of time as we prepared our spaceships to move into the fathomless reaches of interstellar space, and on reaching the constellation of Centaurus, we would need to adapt ourselves to a higher vibratory rate of light and time on the surface of our chosen planet. Now, as the old dimension passes away into the nebulous mists of time, we can only look back into the electric mirage, which retains our past for us, to see the glory of our civilization in the time of the Venus period. Now we have moved beyond a time barrier in the solar system into the time of a highly advanced system, stable and beautiful, without the violence of variable stars. You, my dear, have adapted well to our time dimension. We are not creatures apart in the material body. The reality lies in our magnetic link with our parent stars. Each solar system throughout the living galaxy is relative. All living creatures on the planets are connected, their brains emit radio waves and their hearts electrical rhythms in unison with the star of their system. Until people of Earth discover this truth, they will continue to destroy themselves and all around them. Akon's stern warning cut across my consciousness like a knife. There is a strange urgency to the question of their spaceflight propulsion, he continued. It is a fact that their star, the Sun, is dying, or changing in the cycles of time. It is purely a metamorphosis. They need to pool all their scientific knowledge and ability to perfect space travel and seek another waxing star. They must stop their eternal warring among themselves before it is too late and the Sun expands again in its cycle of lethal radiation. The vast amount of human energy and time now being spent on rocket research is of no avail. It will not solve the problem of interstellar travel. Men of Earth continue to fight with violence to attain power over others while their planet is in mortal danger, and the selfishness of nations restrains a struggling humanity from becoming aware of the portents of danger encircling their world. Is there a possibility of helping them to accelerate their space program? I asked. The fantastic light propulsion of your spaceships, can you not explain to them your alien science? The lines down Akon's cheeks etched deeper with the sternness of his reply. The stage of evolution reached by humankind on Earth forbids any form of communication or support. Only when they change their attitude of mind, when they become gentle and peace-loving and have the ability to love and cherish all fauna and flora on their planet, will we contact them. At the present time, they have still not acquired spiritual advancement. They crawl and live upon the bottom of their atmospheric seas like slugs of the airy depths attuned to their immediate environment. Their eyes are sensitive to only a limited segment of the spectrum of light, and their senses are dulled by their material existence. Gone is the enlightenment of yore, the individual perception. Gone is the ideal life of the great universal civilization, moving in rhythm with the universe in cycles visible and invisible, which removed all uncertainty from life and provided the cosmic certainty on which civilizations thrive. In this present cycle of Earth time, we find our universal human civilization collapsed, with only fragments of its secrets surviving in isolated civilizations of antiquity. This poor restless planet now harbors a race of humans confused and overcome by the forces of evil. This was created by their own low spiritual energy, and they resort to aggressive violence and destruction of their own species in frantic attempts to recapture the old magic. Some withdraw before the growing confusion, dedicating themselves and their successors to preserving a spiritual tradition and participating in the dreamlike current of life where all men experience a state of union with the universe or to them, God. The whole process of degeneration on Earth has been accompanied by a flood of words from social and political reformers, religious leaders and philosophers. Vast stacks of books lie dormant in libraries throughout the world, their meaning misunderstood and lost in a torrent of many words. Words written or spoken cannot solve the problems of Earth, as it becomes ever more apparent that fresh combinations of words fail to penetrate the barrier of thought and prejudice among humans on Earth. The whole level of human consciousness must be raised to enable us to cooperate in any field of philosophy or science. We can only observe and contain them on their planet, while the conditioned attitudes of the human hordes cease to hold opinions as freshly inspired tyrants drive them on and over the bodies of their predecessors. This action solves the problem of such civilizations, which cannot attain enlightenment and harmony, but must destroy themselves within the violence to which they have been conditioned. We live in a violent universe. Unless men of Earth can learn to detach themselves and escape from the forces of violence in which their existence is set, they are doomed to eternal destruction. Men of Earth are misusing the holy secrets of nature, even causing magnetic lines of force to be irretrievably disrupted. Akin went on, again condemning the stupidity of humankind on Earth. It is indeed sad to observe the way they are poisoning the priceless gift of their glorious atmosphere. Stupidity and ignorance are the causes of this devastation. The flora and fauna are now suffering in the murky depths created by the mindless folly of humankind. In times to come, they will smother in their own filth like bloated slugs groping in the smog of disaster. We can remain only for very short periods of time in the sun's system. To land on Earth and remain in her atmosphere for any length of time is becoming increasingly impossible because of the amount of pollution that now exists. Only in the high foothills of the mountains can we now breathe with comfort the life-giving air of Earth. Is it not possible even now to show people of Earth the way to spiritual and scientific survival? I persisted. The way your civilization achieved it? Indeed, we can show them. But the differences are apparently insurmountable. Earth's authorities have shown an aggressive reaction to our approach, giving orders to their air forces to shoot us down, or as that is impossible, to ram our spaceships with their own craft to bring our ships to ground. In this way, they could hope to find access to our superior technology, which of course is all they want. Under these circumstances, we do not contact heads of governments or military authorities. The responsibilities of administration and organization lie with us, the scientists. We make decisions and control all aspects of life within our civilization. The key to our science retains our control and freedom throughout the galaxy, as we tap and use this cosmic energy and generate electricity from the atmospheres of planets for our power needs. Our propulsion system for spaceships is the only true escape route to the stars, and we guard these secrets of our science with our lives against misuse by other civilizations. 5. The Heights of Cathkin. A thing of beauty, Earth moves there, floating in the fathomless depths of space. The planet is alone and unprotected, vulnerable, yet nourishing the form of humankind. An atom of beauty and life floating there against the unwinking stars, who are indifferent to her fate. She is a minute atom in the vast circumference of the galaxy, yet she harbors the specter of man the predator. Looming closer in the lens, Earth's higher atmosphere glowed to form a hazy pink crescent around the shadow side Earth's shadow, a dark azure blue between the glow and the surface. The rounded body of the planet lay still in darkness as the gold and blue of sunrise streaked the atmospheric bands with translucent veils, the dark curve of the planet concealing the flaring disk of the sun as it rotated smoothly beneath us. I saw the deep violet blue of the high atmosphere, and then we came in through the counterglow to land with a feather-like touchdown on the top of the hill. Akin looked deep into my eyes with tender concern, willing me to accept without question the moment of parting. "We now return you to the hill on which I found you, my beloved," he whispered, drawing me close. I shall return soon. We moved toward the curved wall of the spaceship and the door slid back into the double walls. We stepped out onto the hull and back to the soil of Earth as the sun set over the Drakensberg in the west. Sharon waved from the open doorway with a flashing smile. With a lump in my throat, I turned to Akin. Gently, he kissed me, and without a word we both turned away. Quickly I walked away from the great ship as the door closed behind Akin's tall figure. I moved out of range as the ship rose straight up to hover for a moment high in the sky, catching the last rays of the sun, which flashed in rainbow colors around it. For a moment it seemed to merge into the counterglow before moving with a sudden burst of light into the rising shadow of Earth. And then they were gone, in a flash of brilliant light, back into the fathomless seas of space and away beyond the light barrier, where the uncharted void of timelessness rules the destiny of planets. It was rapidly getting dark as I turned homeward. The homestead lay some 3 miles away, nestled in a valley in the rolling grass country of the Drakensberg foothills. The mountains were dark now against the glow in the west, except for the winding ribbon of track over the pass. As I stood alone in the veldt, there was a sudden rustling. A bufana broke cover out of the long grass, scattering like a covey of quail, the whites of their eyes showing with fright in the gloom. I called to them in Zulu, telling them not to be afraid of the great wagon in the sky, but my words fell on deaf ears. No explanation could still the overpowering, superstitious fear of anything so fantastic in the sky, and the children ran on in silent fright back to their kai in the valley. Old Mutti, the Induna and Cook, would be the first to hear the tale. It would be told with extravagant embellishment by the eldest Umfana, who would run like a hare through the grass back to the farmhouse kitchen. Mutti had taken over the family affairs, stepping into Ladam's place after the old man died. The high altitude and cold winters had shortened Ladam's lifespan, and I missed the watchful glance of his wise old eyes and the wisdom of his gentle philosophy. Nobody had questioned the decision made by Mutti to take Ladam's place, and he wielded his authority with clever and wily foresight, summing up the nature of the Umlungu with a facade of respectable honesty. I could not remain silent, I thought. I needed to tell my sister the whole story before she heard it from Mutti. As I saw the soft glow of lamplight from the farmhouse windows, I blessed the dim light of lamps and candles, which would afford a gentle cover for the radiance in my eyes. But my sister would know the moment she saw my face anyway. There could be no secrets in this house. I was brought back to the realization of Earth time by the Zulu maid bringing the early morning tea. The next morning I awoke from a deep and refreshing sleep and stretched my limbs in an ecstasy of happiness. Glancing through the wide open window, I noticed the sun glinting on the tops of the gum trees, that same fearful sun, a glaring, intense sphere of lethal radiation floating in the void of space. I could never forget how the great writhing disk had engulfed us with its immensity through the viewing lens in the spaceship. I recalled those boiling, expanding gases of the convection regions, brilliantly writhing in continuous waves and branches of light, and the stupendous energy of the dense radiations emitted outward from the photosphere. Radiation is the process of transfer deep inside, the photoelectric process of bluish radiations. Here at the bottom of Earth's atmospheric ocean, these same radiations are filtered and diffused into a glowing light with the soft blue sky above. Gone was the deep sadness of my parting from Akin. Instead, a great happiness and contentment filled my soul. I lived again through all the wonderful things he had said to me, the touch of his hands, the exciting, electric presence of such a gentle and possessive man. He was a man from another planet, another world, a real man, not just a figment of my imagination or a dream or a thought, but real. He was real, with as physical a body as anyone else on this planet. This stirring and wonderful contact with my beloved, whom I had known in my heart all my life, is the only real, tangible thing that has ever happened to me. Everything else in my daily life on Earth seems more like a dream to me. I feel I am not really a part of it, and therefore I must belong to Akin's dimension in space and time. Perhaps there are many people living on Earth who have this same experience of the variable nature of space and time, and can move at will from one dimension to another, fully aware of the physical nature of both dimensions of matter and antimatter because they are harmonically attuned to both. The key to our existence in the universe is to be harmonically attuned to all things in nature. If one is attuned, one can take part in all things and be an active participant in the variable nature of the cosmos. In this way, one attains all knowledge and perception, and can eventually make physical contact with people beyond Earth's light barrier. My sister was aware of these truths, and was quietly content to accept the reality of Akin's presence in her environment. She was unaware of the future, and did not foresee the suddenness of her physical meeting with him, in the mist, on an evening to come. As Akin had explained to me, there is a simple explanation for the fact that people from another planet are able to visit Earth if they wish to. Within the protection of their giant spaceships of light, the fantastic starships shaped like galaxies, they are completely safe and mobile. Most Earth people are unable to understand the advanced physics of this alien science. Their minds are limited to the comprehension of their own narrow environment. Not for them the vast secrets of the universe and how the wave motion of light controls the destiny of humankind, its pulse wave creating the vast and everlasting waves of the oceans. Its spiral system encompasses the vast circumference and reaches of the galaxy in an everlasting creation of energy and matter. Its varying frequencies give us the nature of existence in matter and antimatter, creating stars, planets and people adapted to the surfaces of planets in varying frequencies of time. As the pulse of energy moves within the substance of land, rocks or earth, its pulse wave can be seen undulating across the solid landscape in the form of earthquakes perceptible to the frequency of our eyes. I was brought back to the realization of Earth time by the Zulu maid bringing the early morning tea. She paused for a moment on her way out, her dark brown eyes wide and soft with devotion. "You watched the sky wagon?" I gently asked in her own tongue. "Inkasikazi, we have seen Numalingo wagon in the sky. We ran to hide in a donga, shielding our eyes from the brightness like the lightning. Our fathers told of such things coming out of the sky, and the Inanga Yezilu says he has seen them many times and has talked to them when they create a great black cloud with lightning and thunder." She spoke with awe, hardly daring to talk about such things she could never understand. "Umthakurthi," she said as she scurried through the door and fled to the kitchen. "Wizard, sorcerer or witch." Later in the morning, my sister and I mounted on two of the quietest mares and rode to the mountaintop. Where the great spaceship had landed, the long grass remained flattened in a vast circle. The horses refused to approach, but stood with their heads down, snorting and trembling in every limb. Sensing the alien presence, the old mare I was riding suddenly reared and turned on her hocks to flee. But I checked her and brought her down quietly with soothing words and reassuring hands. She stood quietly then, her nostrils flaring now and again as she snorted her defiance to the alien something that had left its scent on the veldt. The reactions of the mares made my sister very nervous, and she allowed her mount to shy away from the awesome circle of flattened grass. "Were you not afraid, Elizabeth?" she asked. "How did you know and learn not to be afraid?" Without waiting for an answer, she dismounted from her mare and gave the reins to an umfana who stood nearby, gaping at the flattened circle of veldt. The small boy was so engrossed with what he saw that the mare easily jerked the reins from his hands and galloped away down the hill. My mare reared again in her attempt to follow, but I quieted her. I moved her away from the landing area and dismounted. The whole neighborhood was there, squatting in the long grass on top of the mountain. The Imakla and Izar Lukazi were gesticulating wildly and talking at the top of their voices. "Old men, old women, I told you so," they called. "Ladam foretold this. This mountain is Umling." Leaving the mare with my sister, I stepped into the circle of flat grass. Standing in the center, I looked up into the depths of blue, into the far reaches of the sky and the fathomless seas of space, knowing the truth and the golden glory of love's light. The Zulu women began to chant, setting up a high-pitched wail and turning their faces to the heavens, calling on Unkulunkulu to preserve for all time the hallowed mountain and the spot where the great wagon of the skies had landed. God, if only someone was here with a movie film, soundtrack and a lot, my sister called out in her practical way and the spell was broken. Zulu matrons and maidens stood up out of the long waving grass, and with graceful dignity moved off along the mountain path, their gaily beaded skirts swinging with the motion of their stride. The children ran on ahead, naked except for strings of beads. The married women wore colorful capes that blew in the wind and carried infants on their backs. Their heavy, clay-matted head adornments were done in distinctive styles peculiar to the district. The menfolk remained in hushed conclave, squatting on their haunches in the long grass, while the women and children returned to the semicircle of beehive-shaped huts on the lower slopes of the mountain. Like a curved horn, the hut emplacement nestled on the northeastern slope. The long stems of grass, which made both the thatch of the roof and the walls tied to a shell of wattle, glistened in the morning sunlight. There was only one low entrance to each hut, shielded from the wind by a grass screen that was curved on a wooden frame and beaded in many colors. The clay floors within were made of a mixture of fresh cow dung and earth. Worshipping the spirits of their ancestors, who came from the heaven country, the Amazulu prepared to celebrate the return of the sky gods. Young men loped off into the veldt, spreading the message to the distant kraals. They covered kilometers of rolling country with their easy, loping stride and drummed a knob kiri against the inner side of a hide shield. A stick with a knob at one end. The runaway mare was caught and returned to my sister. We mounted and rode slowly back to the homestead. "When will Akan come back again?" my sister asked. My heart missed a beat at the thought of next time. Would it be soon? The warmth of my love brought a flush to my cheeks, and I looked back to the mountaintop as I answered. "It could be any time. We must just wait." Back in the old farmhouse, we quietly discussed the subject as Mutti came from the kitchen laden with a tray of delicious tea and freshly baked scones. He placed the tray on the table for us, and then retreated to hover in the shadows beyond the door, hoping to catch some of our conversation. "We have sent our best reporters over to Pretoria to see the Air Chief of Staff." The chief, anxiously awaiting news of me, sent an urgent telegram to ascertain my whereabouts. I dispatched a full report to him, and was happy to receive an excited and very encouraging letter in response. He stated that my news was of such vital import that he was flying out to South Africa to see me. Upon his arrival, we returned to the farm and spent many hours out on the mountaintop, while a lone Air Force Harvard droned and circled in the sky overhead. Flying Saucer Hill remained aloof, however, to all who came to peer and search for clues as many people did, trespassing from the far road. "What with all these people and the Air Force surveillance," the chief said, "you will have to find another meeting place or wait a long time before you see Akan again. Let the hue and cry die down," he advised me before he returned to England. "People soon forget." On my return to Johannesburg, Flying Saucer enthusiasts questioned me and clamored for information as the fantastic story came out in the press. My training and powers of observation into human nature prevented me from laying all my facts bare, for these were not the people to confide in and tell of things beyond their comprehension. They were a motley crowd of cranks and self-seekers, some of them very vicious and dangerous, I thought. Early in 1956, Johannesburg was a hotbed of Flying Saucer intrigue. Societies flourished like fungi in the bracing warmth of the hiveless summer, watered by the fanatical enthusiasm of many misguided individuals whose egotism far outweighed any good they attempted to do. Dogfights and bickering were the order of the day, and UFO research societies crumbled and withered through gross ignorance and vicious jealousy. They shouted to the four winds that they were the experts. Only they were capable of making any statements about flying saucers. While they tried to steal the limelight for themselves, the situation steadily deteriorated. As the tempo of viciousness increased, I sensed how dearly they would love to revert to their natural instincts and burn me at the stake as a witch. Then, suddenly, their tactics changed. I was threatened with abduction if I refused to hand over scientific details of the flying saucer and its propulsion systems. The danger to me and my family increased daily. Threatening telephone calls and letters made our lives increasingly difficult and fraught with danger, even in our own home. How dare they? I thought. Because I was living alone with my children in a cottage in Park Town, they thought I would be easy bait to snatch and hold. I appealed to the authorities for protection, and they responded with prompt and very effective action. An ex-policeman was detailed to guard my home, and from then on I was never allowed to go anywhere by myself. It was wonderful to have peace and not be threatened anymore. The days passed and the weather was perfect as it can be only on the Highveld. My daughter studied for her medical degree at the university just down the road, and my son attended day school. Then one day events changed again, dramatically, as the Air Force appeared, sweeping across the mackerel sky in a wide swathe. High above, a great spaceship hovered at 19,000 meters of altitude, flashing in the morning sunlight. The jets, scrambled from Waterkloof Air Force Base to investigate, were unable to climb above 14,000 meters. They swept away to the north in battle formation, leaving long, tenuous vapor trails. The wide open sky retained the tranquility of eternity and the silent watcher high above remained a circular starship, glowing and flashing high above the cirro cumulus. Indifferent to the excitement and consternation in the great city sprawling over the ridge of white waters, the silent watcher remained, glowing within her light field. Filled with wonder and awe, thousands of people watched and waited. Fear of the unknown entered many hearts, and the condensation trails of the fighter jets hung across the higher atmosphere like the wing feathers of the wind. Suddenly, out of the depths of space, another starship appeared. The two ships remained hovering, moving gently from side to side and up and down for a time. Then one of them made off to the south at great speed and vanished. The second great spaceship lowered a little in the clear noonday sky and then vanished also, as suddenly as it had appeared. My heart filled with joy as I watched from the spacious garden of a friend. Akin was back and he had contacted my mind through the ether of the heavens. The warmth of his love coursed through my whole being and filled my soul with a sudden glow. My body stirred to the glory of his presence as the ocean is stirred by the winds of a heavenly calm, and the golden rays of love poured the radiance of the universe into my eyes as I gazed into the depths of blue from whence he came. Noting the radiance in my face, my friends questioned me about the spaceship. I told them it was Akin's ship, and that I would now have to go back to the mountains. Taking my leave of them, I quickly drove my MG out of the drive and back down the hill to my cottage. The shrill and strident urgency of the telephone greeted my homecoming, and I answered it. Elizabeth? A flying saucer over Johannesburg. What do you know? Never seen anything like it. There is bedlam here in the newspaper offices. I could hear a babble of voices from the other end of the telephone. What a row. I answered. I can't hear anything you say now. You will have to shout. We have sent our best reporters over to Pretoria to see the Air Chief of Staff. Are you going to the farm, Elizabeth? What is happening? I'm sure it will all be on the radio, I said. You must listen in. Bye, now. I have to go. I put the receiver down and told my son to pack for the farm, including warm clothes. Then I went to my writing desk to await my sister's call. The previous evening, I remembered, had been quiet and perfect. A waxing moon had nudged up beyond the clouds on the eastern horizon. The green wealth of trees and shrubs that flowed down the hill swayed gently in a fresh wind from the east. From the zoo, the peacocks called, their plaintive notes swelling with the wind a warning of storms to come. I noted that the sky had now cleared, even the high cirrus had gone. A cold front would come up later from the south, however. Instinctively, I looked into the sky. I could tell by reading its sheen that a change of weather was coming. The telephone trilled again, an urgent summons, and my sister's voice came through, clear and perfect. "Come immediately, my dear," she said. "And watch the weather. We are leaving now." Akin would be there, I thought. My heart sang a paean of joy. "Ready?" I asked my son. "Let's go."
"Right, Mom." David's excited voice answered from the depths of a jersey as he pulled it over his head.